from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, Melinda Gates of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation joins us. She says the key to changing the world is empowering women and makes her case in a new book called The Moment of Lift. Then powerful Democrats are accusing Attorney General William Barr of committing a crime and threatening to hold him in contempt of Congress. House Speaker Nancy Pelosi says Barr lied to Congress, and House Judiciary Chair Gerald Nadler says Barr is defying a subpoena for the full Mueller report. So what happens now? We find out on Forum after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. When Melinda Gates became one of the few women to graduate from Duke in the late 80s with a computer science degree and an MBA, she went to work for a then smallish company called Microsoft. There, she met and married Bill Gates, and Microsoft's incredible success has given Melinda Gates the opportunity to travel to some of the most impoverished or remote places in the world and meet women living on the margins. In her new book titled The Moment of Lift, Gates shares their stories and how they've informed her belief that the key to changing the world is in helping women claim their power. Melinda Gates, welcome to Forum.
Thanks for having me, Mina.
Well, a central argument in your book, The Moment of Lift, How Empowering Women Changes the World, is that a key tool for empowering women is access to contraception.
Absolutely. It's the greatest anti-poverty tool that we have. When women can time and space the births of their children, the women are healthier, their children are healthier, the kids are better educated, and the families are overall wealthier. We know that from a great longitudinal global health study.
And I was struck by how you came to that conclusion. You write about how you were working hard on getting vaccines to people, and you had a lot of women coming up to you in line for vaccines or taking their children to get vaccinated and talking to you about contraception. Can you tell us about some of those stories, about some of those encounters?
Sure. It really surprised me. I would be there to talk about vaccines, and women would say, but what about my health? What about my contraceptive? Why is it I've come to this clinic and I can get childhood vaccinations for my kids, and I've walked 10 miles in the heat to get them, but contraceptives used to be available here, and they're not anymore? And women would say, I can't have another child. I can hardly feed this child or the other three I have. And so I started to learn that, in fact, women not only were asking us for contraceptives, we had stopped delivering them as a world. And over 200 million women were telling us they want access to contraceptives.
And as you noted, that you believe contraceptives really are the greatest poverty-ending innovation. How do you know that, besides these anecdotes?
Because we know that there's no low-income country that has ever made it to middle-income country without first allowing access to contraceptives. And the global health research that I cited earlier about kids being healthier, better educated, families being wealthier, that's the longest longitudinal global health study that's ever been done, that was done back in the 1970s in Bangladesh, where they allowed certain villages access to contraceptives and other ones didn't have access.
And one of the things that I think is powerful about your book is you connect the experience of spacing pregnancies to your own experience, that you came to realize that your ability to do that for yourself with your three children played a pivotal role in your ability to do the work that you do for the foundation and become, to be a co-founder and a leader as well.
Yes, I tell about my experience. My children, it's no mistake, I was lucky enough to have children, but that they are each spaced 3 years apart. That's what Bill and I chose. And the reason I tell that story and I speak up about it is I think we have sort of forgotten in the United States that it was the advent of the birth control pill that allowed women to stay in university longer and allowed them to go into the workforce if they chose. But we have to have that ability to time and space the births of our pregnancies If we want to have any, you know, our full, I should say, potential in life and to thrive, we need that tool.
And you also write that you were a good Catholic girl. So how do you reconcile the Catholic Church's stance on contraception and this very, you know, powerful statement that you make about it?
Well, I think those two things are not reconcilable. And I had to really struggle with my faith because I am still a Catholic. And I believe in the social justice mission that I have learned from the Catholic Church. However, it also teaches love thy neighbor. And we know that over 90% of Catholic women today use contraceptives. And so if you really love other people equally, if you believe, as Bill and I do, that all lives have equal value, we need to be delivering this tool in the developing world as a global health community and let women take that decision themselves.
And because of your prominence, have you gotten pushback from leaders in the Catholic Church?
I have. I helped lead a global coalition in 2012 to put this issue, contraceptives, back on the global health agenda. And after that big conference that we ran on it, that we announced that we were doing this, we brought together a coalition to raise resources for it. I did get attacked by the Catholic Church in the Vatican newspaper. But that's okay by me, to be frank. I'm speaking my truth. I'm speaking what I know to be true after 20 years of travels three times a year to the developing world. And I know that this is a life-saving tool, and I believe in saving mothers and children's lives.
Do you think you could have said that, say, 10 years ago, Melinda Gates? Because one of the things that you write about in your book is sort of your journey to find your voice and to claim your own power.
Yes, I write about my own journey, and because I believe that equality can't wait. And I believe that we have this window of time that is opened because of the Me Too movement, because of women coming out in the 2018 elections and running for Congress. We need to make sure that while this window is open, we take advantage of that. And so I talk about my own journey because I think we have to find equality in our homes and in our communities and in our workplaces. And it's when we do that, that we lift up all of society.
Yes, you have a line in your book where you talk about your friend Killian, and you say, "She helped me see that I cannot stand for gender equality in the world unless I have it in my marriage." What was it like to be married to such a large public persona like Bill Gates? And I know you've shared quite a bit the story of how you nudged him to begin dropping off one of your kids at kindergarten because it was something that you wanted him to take more of a role in terms of the family and recognizing how much time it really took for you to drop her off and do all the other things that you wanted to do for her. But I was struck by another anecdote in your story that I don't know that I've heard you talk about as much, which was when you made a rule about mom cannot be the last person to leave the kitchen anymore. Can you talk about that story a little bit?
Yes, sure. So we had already committed, Bill and I, that we would do dishes as a family after dinner. That's what we both had done in our own families growing up. And so we have three children. The five of us would get up and after dinner, we would all do the dishes together. But I realized one night, you know, everybody would wander back upstairs, Bill to his desk, the kids to do homework or whatever they were doing. And I was still down in the kitchen kind of doing those whatever the last minute tasks were, right? You know, wiping down the placemats or whatever the things were. And I wouldn't get upstairs till maybe 15 or 20 minutes later. And so in my frustration, the next night, everybody was about to wander off and I wasn't very nice about it, I don't think. I put my hands on my hips and I said, "Nobody leaves the kitchen till mom leaves the kitchen." And guess what? That 15 minutes turns into about 3 minutes when all five people jump in and realize what needs to get done so everybody can then go upstairs. And I tell that story because that is the story in our homes of all the unpaid labor that women do. And in the United States, women spend 90 minutes more per day of unpaid labor in their home than their husbands do. And we need to look at that and recognize it and name it and redistribute it.
We're talking with Melinda Gates, philanthropist, co-founder of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, about her new book, The Moment of Lift, How Empowering Women Changes the World. And we're talking about her experiences working with women in developing countries, and as well as trying to achieve gender equality in her own marriage to Bill Gates. I'd like to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. We have Melinda Gates with us for the first half hour, so the time to call is now. Perhaps you have some thoughts on what investments that you think would advance gender equality or have big impact either here or globally, or maybe on a personal level you can share with us when you've advocated for equality in your own relationships. The number 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. Post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. On Facebook, you can tweet us at KQED Forum, or you can email us at forum@kqed.org. Melinda Gates, I think the other thing that I was struck by that story was what you wrote afterwards when you described the rule that no one gets to leave the kitchen until mom leaves the kitchen. And you write, if I tried to read the minds of my readers here, I would worry that some of you might be thinking, oh no, the privileged lady is tired of being the last one in the kitchen all by herself, but she doesn't have to get up before the sun. Her kids don't have to take the bus. Her childcare support is reliable. She has a partner who is willing to drive the kids and do the dishes. I know, I'm describing my own scene, not because it's a problem, but because it's my vantage point on the problem. Do you feel like people have a lot of ideas and labels about you as a result of the fact that you are someone of great wealth?
I do see that. And I think when I walk into a room, people have me in a role or a label. And what I want to do is break that down and let them know that we are all at the core the same human beings. And yes, I am incredibly lucky and privileged to have the resources from Microsoft. I am the first one to tell you that. But I also have my own experience, and I think it's important that we all share our experiences and we share how we're working towards equality in our home, in our communities, and in our workplaces, because it's in sharing our stories and our shared experiences that we have more awareness and we grow and we see ways that we can change as men and as women. And that's what moves society forward.
How were you able to get women with so few resources to relate to you, to share these very powerful stories about their lives? I mean, you even tell the story of a woman who is named Meena, actually, in northern India, who asked you to take her sons, that she felt like the only way that she could give them a chance in life is if they had a different mother.
Yes. So I go in about three times a year into these various low-income countries, all over different places in Africa, Southeast Asia. And I just go in as a Western woman in a pair of khaki pants and a T-shirt. So they just know I'm from the U.S. That's all they know. And when you sit in these villages and you stay for a long time and you sit on a mat with other women and you share maybe some tea and you start to talk, they will share the stories of their lives. And by listening to their stories, it's helped call me to action to see where the issues are all over the world for women, both in their countries, but quite honestly, it got me to turn the question back to myself about our own country and equality. Mm-hmm. And so it's in sharing our humanity that we start to see where the work needs to be done.
Well, let's go to our callers, and we'll start with Helena in San Francisco. Hi, Helena or Helena, am I saying your name correctly?
Helena, thank you so much. As a woman myself and a member of the Sunrise Movement, I want to point out that empowering women is also key to stopping climate change, and that's in the U.S. as well as around the world. And I'm proud that the National Green New Deal includes women in the category of people to be consulted for its planning and implementation. And I wanted, Ms. Gates, if you could share your ideas on how to make this happen and improve helping women help stop climate change around the world.
Helena, thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks, Helena. I could not agree with you more. In the developing world, the predominant means for incomes today is farming, and 50% of the farmers are women. And one of the things that we have learned as a world is that if you have a seed that, say, is more drought resistant or more flood resistant, because the rains, the farmers will tell you, are coming at different times in Africa, and they're coming in huge amounts when they do come. If you assume that seed gets out to men and women equally, that is a false assumption. And I talk about this in my book. women are not served by the agro dealers in Africa. So we have to do specific things to hear the women's voices, to hear what crops they want to plant, and to make sure that as new seeds come out, they get into women's hands. Because when women can get more yield off their farm, guess what? They plow that income into the health and education of their kids. It's really remarkable. So women have to have a voice and a seat at the table in all of these climate change decisions.
Well, Helena, thanks for the question. And I want to go next to Mara in Mountain View. Hi, Mara.
Hi there. Yeah, my question is, in talking to all these women in these other countries, did you come across women also asking for safe abortion practices?
Mara, thank you. Melinda Gates.
Yes. Yes, Mara. So in the developing world, the clinics that women go to, there are often very few clinics. And where the clinics are, the women will walk. They will tell you they walk miles and miles and miles. And in those clinics, they often can have contraceptive counseling, voluntary access to contraceptives, when and if the tools are available. They actually haven't been available now for a long time. And those are often the same clinics that provide abortion services. You probably know that USAID's funding in when it's under a Republican administration is restricted, so that there's actually less funding that goes to contraceptives because USAID has a restriction on it called the Mexico City policy under any Republican administration. And so less funding actually goes for contraceptives because the clinics cannot be separated in the developing world. It is one clinic.
And, you know, I have to ask you, we've learned that the Trump administration has finalized a rule that gives healthcare workers essentially leeway to refuse to provide services like abortions, other things as well, sterilizations or assisted suicides, if they basically end up contradicting their religious views or as religious conscientious objectors. That could also include contraception. What is your reaction to that?
My reaction is that I think, you know, Congress has to really, really look at what is being proposed here, because that is a very slippery slope. You start saying people can conscientiously object because of certain issues that we're talking about here that he's proposing. How far does that go? Does that also mean that if you don't believe in gay rights, you're going to not give hospital or clinic services to people who have gay rights? You know, we do have a separation in our country of state and church, and I think that has served our democracy incredibly well. So I think what is being proposed here is quite dangerous.
You also spend a lot of time talking about how contraception reduces abortions and the need for
absolutely.
Abortion.
Absolutely.
And how,
I mean,
yes, go ahead.
Absolutely. Contraceptives are not only the greatest anti-poverty tool we have, they absolutely, around the world, we have good data, they reduce the number of abortions. I have to be honest, I have never met a woman in the world who has told me she wanted to be in the situation where she had to have an abortion. So why we believe in contraceptives, we use them at a 90% plus rate in the United States. Even Catholic women, more than 90% use them. So if we can allow voluntary access to contraceptives, it will keep many, many, many millions of women from ever needing to go into the situation where they have to go into the clinic for abortion, which is why I am so for contraceptives.
Well, this is a point from Kim. She writes, people like Bill and Melinda Gates are able to determine where philanthropy money is spent, partly due to the tax avoidance by large corporations. These are not altruistic people. What's your response to Kim?
My response to Kim is that Bill and I are strongly on record saying that we absolutely believe in the United States. High-income people should pay more taxes than middle-income people, and middle-income people in our country should pay more than low-income people. And so the tax policy, I welcome this debate and this criticism that has come up in the last 8 months, and I think it's time that the tax policy be re-looked at in the United States and updated. In addition, I would say that philanthropy does have a role, but it is a limited role. What philanthropy can do is it can take risks, It can try things that you wouldn't want your government to do with taxpayer money. And if those projects actually prove themselves out and can be measured, then you want the government to scale those projects up with taxpayer funding. So yes, philanthropy has a role, but it's a limited role alongside government, private sector, and civil society.
Well, let's go next to Michelle in Berkeley. Hi, Michelle.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I'm very interested in hearing how the Gates Foundation navigates dealing with repressive governments. On Wednesday, Bill Gates tweeted a very complimentary tweet to Mohammed bin Rashid, the ruler of the United Arab Emirates, regarding his commitment to helping to end polio. But meanwhile, the UAE is part of a coalition that has been waging war on Yemen, which has resulted in what the UN has called the world's worst humanitarian crisis. You know, thousands facing starvation, cholera, not to mention the impact of the bombing itself. The UAE is also terribly repressive. I'll just give you one example. Ahmed Mansour, who was sort of like the Liu Xiaobo of the UAE, he has been in prison for the second time. He's been in solitary confinement for 2 years simply for pro-democracy blogging.
Well, Michelle, let me see if I can get a response from Melinda Gates. Navigating dealing with repressive governments, Melinda Gates.
Yes, so great question, Michelle. And it is very, it's a tricky balancing act between when we work with a government and when we don't. We believe that all lives have equal value. And so we look at, is a government acting honorably on behalf of young children in particular? So I believe that's probably why Bill sent, I have to be honest, I haven't followed his social media in a couple of days. I'm on the road. But that's probably why Bill sent that tweet out. But then we also look and balance that with your humanitarian rights. And so, you know, it's a balancing act, and we are constantly looking at it. We try to get it right. We probably don't always get it right.
Well, speaking of social media and not getting it right, I did see that you tweeted last night that you were responsible for Clippy, the paperclip that would give, and then you apologized for it.
I did run the team that came out with a product called Microsoft Bob. You probably don't remember it because very few people used it. But yes, Clippy lived on, and as did the comics serif font. So if you like that, some people do, Comic Sans, some don't. You can also say that was from that team. So yes, we tried things at Microsoft, and some of them worked and some of them failed. Some of them you like, some of them you probably don't like.
And I imagine it's the same with philanthropy. Though, as you seek ways to find the biggest bang for your buck in terms of improving the situation of others, you've certainly made central women. Melinda Gates' book is The Moment of Lift, How Empowering Women Changes the World. Thank you so much for talking with us this morning.
Thanks for having me, Mina.
Melinda Gates, co-founder of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. We've got another half hour of forum coming up. We're going to talk about William Barr, so stay with us for that.